is under the administrative detention, don't have any charge, and they don't know why they are arrested. They can't have a lawyer, and they don't know when they are going to leave the jails. There are detainees who spent more than 10 years with no legal charge. Most administrative detainees are on a hunger strike defending their right to freedom. We are holding a campaign to tell the detainees that they are not alone.
The illegal administrative detention policy allows the Israeli regime to extend the detention of a prisoner without charge or trial and prevents them from having a lawyer.
Today, Palestinians are protesting here against the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention practiced against our people with no charge. Supporting the Palestinian detainees and their issue is a priority for us. We call on all human groups to stand by the detainees and bring an end to Israel's administrative detention.
Since the beginning of August, 17 Palestinian detainees have begun a hunger strike to protest against their administrative detention. Palestinians have called on the international community to break its silence over the prisoners' issue and stop the illegal policy to save the lives of Palestinian prisoners.
The administrative detention policy totally contradicts international law and violates human rights. I personally was suffering from this illegal policy for 3 years inside Israeli jails, and I can tell you the tragedy administrative detainees live with. Being arrested with no charge and having no court for an unknown number of years are what administrative detainees suffer from. Unfortunately, the human rights groups and the international community are aware of this tragedy, but don't move a stone.
There are almost 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, including women and children, as well as administrative detainees, who are arrested with no charge amid the silence of the international community. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Under the title, The Blockade and Raising Customs Tariffs is an American Crime, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a to stand against the recent decision of the former President Hadi government to raise the customs tariff by 100% on the imports to Aden Port amid the continued closure of Hodeidah Port by Saudi Arabia.
Yemenis came out to the streets today to tell the whole world that raising the customs tariffs and the financial and economic siege on Yemen must come to an end. Yemenis have been steadfast for years and will prove to the world that Yemen is the graveyard of invaders militarily and economically.
Protesters said the new tariff rate will negatively affect the prices of basic commodities, including food and medicine, amid the already dire humanitarian situation due to the ongoing Saudi war and siege.
Raising the prices of customs tariffs will negatively affect the prices of foodstuffs and all other basic commodities. And this is unacceptable. We are living the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, and this decision will constitute an additional crisis in light of what we have been experiencing for 7 years.
They have also said the U.S. and the Saudi led coalition imposed this new tariff rate to force Yemenis to surrender after they have failed in the military field.
The aim of the decision to raise the tariff is to force the Yemenis to surrender. But our principles and morals reject this, and we will continue our steadfastness until we achieve victory. The enemies have failed to defeat us through creating difficult economic situation for us.
Yemen is on the brink of famine and facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations, since the Saudi-led coalition backed by Washington launched a devastating war on the war-ravaged nation at the beginning of 2015.
People here say that Washington is back in the Saudi siege, which is threatening the lives of millions of Yemenis, including children. They say the continued apathy of the international community is yet another proof of the U.S. participation of the brutal war on their country. Al-Latif Roshali, Sana'a.
The South Korean government extended its highest level of social distancing for 2 more weeks as new cases of COVID-19 drag on at over 1,500 per day, the most since the beginning of the pandemic in early 2020.
The speed of the ongoing outbreak is slowing, but the size of the outbreak is still big, and this shows it's unclear if the outbreak will display a downward trajectory soon. The movement of people is not decreasing as much as desired, and the Delta variant cases continue to increase.
The more contagious Delta variant of the virus is responsible for more than half of the new cases. Private gatherings of more than two people after 6 p.m. are banned, and nightlife is largely shut down. The South Korean government had just announced the relaxation of social distancing guidelines when the fourth wave struck here in early July, forcing officials to reverse course. And pressure now is mounting for relief. Churches have been critical over restrictions on the number of people that can attend services, and unions have held large street rallies challenging the guidelines. Although most people observe government advisories, frustration is growing.
The level of social distancing has been increased and decreased and increased again. Personally, I think that social distancing has no point because it's nonsense. We are now in level 4 of social distancing, but the number of new cases has not decreased.
Officials say measures will be relaxed when case numbers fall. South Korea has so far vaccinated about 15% of the population, with the government now considering booster shots for those most vulnerable. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, said that the recent Israeli attack was a very dangerous development, which has not occurred in the last 15 years, stressing that the resistance needed to respond swiftly.
Our response was linked directly to the two incidents of Israeli Air Force attacks, which targeted Lebanese territory for the first time in 15 years. And our response had very clear tools and objectives. We calculated our moves very precisely. Our enemy and our friends said this. They said open territory. They did not target civilians. So we also targeted open areas with no civilians. But we had many options. We could hit open areas in Sheba Farms, in northern occupied Palestine, or the occupied Golan Heights.
Said Hassan Nasrallah made the remarks in a televised speech to commemorate the 15th anniversary of the 2006 war. He said that Israel deliberately targeted open areas in the middle of the night in order to terrorize civilians, and presumed that the resistance would not respond because of the various domestic problems inside Lebanon. Said Nasrallah stressed that the main deterrence for Israel is the capabilities of the resistance.
The enemy today is more fearful than any time in the past because of the developments in Palestine and the region and the transformations in the region and the ascending strength of the resistance and because of the deep internal divisions and the mutual hatred between the occupying Zionist groups. Facing their internal issues and the strengthening of the resistance, everyone in the Zionist entity is talking about an existential threat.
Experts believe the military potential of Hezbollah has created a balance of deterrence where Israel is incapable of even starting a war.
Israel wants Hezbollah to start the war. The situation will be different. Hezbollah is aware of this, will not Israel let him go to war, you know, anytime Israel wanted.
The leader of Lebanon's resistance noted that in any future confrontation, the Israeli military will disintegrate completely and would be heavily defeated.
The 2006 war had settled a certain status quo, which remains until today, with a new regional equation, which comprises all the resistance groups in the region. Any miscalculation by the Israelis could be detrimental for Israel. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Visiting the famous Eiffel Tower in Paris has become more complicated than before. Now, people have to show an electronic document that proves that they are vaccinated twice. If not, they need to show a negative PCR test. However, most of the visitors do not consider this procedure as a problem.
It's a good opportunity to show that you're vaccinated. For me, this is perfect. This way, we are all sure that we are vaccinated.
I'm fine with it. I mean, if it lets us do things like this, then why not? To go back to some kind of normal, being able to spend time with our family, go on vacation, it's nice.
The same procedure is used to visit public places like the Louvre Museum. Rows are longer than usual because people have to show their pass.
for this pass.
Well, I'm rather in favor of the health pass. If it is to protect everyone and to prevent the virus from spreading, that's better for everybody.
The French Parliament and Senate have voted this new law, and earlier this week, the Constitutional Council has approved the law text. The health pass will now be extended also to restaurants and trains. But protesters continue taking the streets. They were again tens of thousands in France and at least 2,000 in Paris. Why? Jerome Rodriguez, who lost his eye in a previous protest, organized this march. He explains that the problem is not a vaccination, but the limitation of liberties.
We are here to protest against the violation and decline of liberties in France. We are not here against the vaccines. The health pass is just one extra restrictive law after another. The first restrictive law was against the Yellow Vests, the second one about global security, and now the third with the health pass. Macron should take care of the poor people, not only of the rich companies who earned a lot of money during this COVID crisis.
The protesters are especially targeting the French government that is using force rather than persuasion to obtain a double vaccination of a large majority of the French. The reason is medical. Today, most of the people who arrive in hospitals with severe symptoms of the COVID-19 virus are not vaccinated. Most of the people who transmit the virus are not vaccinated either. Despite ongoing protests against the mandatory health pass, the majority of the French is bowing more and more to the medical evidence. Today, vaccination is the only efficient way to hold back the coronavirus. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
This is Pin Baldak, a Afghan border crossing in southwest of Pakistan. North Taliban have shut it down, demanding Pakistan a visa-free movement of Afghan citizens. The complete closure of the border has suspended transportation of edible items and movement of thousands of people from both sides. The Taliban recaptured most of the border crossing with the neighboring countries of Afghanistan in an attempt to lay down a besiege of President Ashraf Ghani's beleaguered government in capital Kabul.
Islamabad has completed 90% of wide fence of nearly 2,700 kilometer long porous border with Afghanistan to contain the movement of terrorists sneaking into Pakistan to carry out terrorist attacks. If visa restriction is removed, Islamabad fears there would be more infiltration of terrorists into Pakistan. Therefore, the government here is unlikely to concede to the Taliban demand of a visa-free movement of Afghan citizens.
It's not a legitimate government who can come up with a legitimate demand, or where it can ask a relationship which is based state to state. It has to legitimize itself, it has to bring itself to an acceptable and internationally recognized position.
The Taliban claim to have recaptured 85% of Afghan territory, controlling over 260 districts, most of which after the withdrawal of US-led NATO forces. The clashes between the Taliban fighters and Afghan National Army have made thousands of families homeless, and many of them were caught in the crossfire, particularly in the southern parts of Afghanistan. The UN has warned an unfolding humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan.
The provincial capitals of Kandahar, Herat, and Lashkargah, in particular, have come under significant pressure. This is a clear attempt by the Taliban to seize urban centers with the force of arms.
The ongoing talks between Taliban and President Ashraf Ghani's government in Doha have so far failed to take off. Both sides remain glued to their respective demands, which has heightened the fear of Taliban overtaking the rest of Afghanistan in near future. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Palestinian groups in the Gaza Strip hailed the Hezbollah's move to fire a parade of rockets toward the Israeli regime in response to Thursday Israeli air raids on South Lebanon. Palestinians welcomed the move, describing it as a strong message to Israel.
The
Lebanese rockets foiled Israeli plans and projects aimed at separating the resistance in the region. It proved that the resistance won't remain silent in the face of the Israeli crimes. The Lebanese response is a message that Israel cannot impose its policies in the region, and the resistance will keep defending its rights.
The Israeli military said its Iron Dome system intercepted 10 of 19 rockets on Friday, with six falling in open areas in a third day of tension across the borders. There have been no reports of casualties or serious damage. Palestinian groups expressed their support to all forms of resistance against Israel and announced their readiness to stand with the resistance movement in Lebanon in defending their rights.
We hail the response of the resistance in Lebanon against Israeli airstrikes. This Lebanese move emphasizes the importance of the resistance in defending its rights and foiling the Israeli policies. The Israeli regime is also still practicing all forms of violence against the Islamic and Arab nations, and the resistance is the only way to put an end to these crimes.
The resistance said it won't allow the Israeli regime to impose new policies in the region and that Israel won't go unpunished for its crimes.
We really welcome the Lebanese move to respond to the Israeli airstrikes in South Lebanon and fire rockets at the occupied territories. We stress that we are all united in resistance to liberating Palestine and getting the Israeli occupation away from the region. We are supporting our brothers in Lebanon, and we are all ready to defend any Israeli aggression against Lebanon.
Palestinian factions here welcome the Lebanese response against the Israeli attacks, stressing on fully supporting the resistance in Lebanon against the Israeli aggression with all means. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says it has fired dozens of rockets near positions of Israeli occupation forces in the Shabaa farms. Hezbollah added that the latest round of rocket fire came in response to the Israeli air raids that hit South Lebanon on Thursday. In an interview with a local agency, Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasim stressed that the resistance is much more capable than it was in 2006, yet downplayed the possibility of an all-out war.
In this phase, the resistance is in an extremely high state of readiness, and it cannot even be compared to the level of capability and alertness which was present in 2006. Whether in the arms, preciseness, military planning, training, preparation, and capabilities. And Israel knows this. So if they launch a foolish aggression under any pretext, Hezbollah will be ready.
An Israeli military spokesman stressed that Israel does not wish to escalate to a full war, but is prepared for it. Experts believe Israel was trying to move escalation towards the inside of Lebanon, but the resistance took things back to square one.
The Israelis have been trying for a while to change the rules of engagement with Lebanon, but Hezbollah's resistance has proven today that the Israelis cannot change the status quo as long as there is a resistance which is ready to face the Israeli aggressions. This was not only retaliation to the latest round of Israeli shelling, it was also a warning and a response to all the violations committed by the Israelis, whether in the air, land, or sea.
Lebanese President Michel Aoun and Lebanese caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab urged the United Nations interim forces in Lebanon to put pressure on Israel to stop its aggressions against Lebanon's sovereignty. Several statements from Palestinian resistance groups were issued in support of Hezbollah's retaliation, which many see as stressing the full legitimacy of resistance groups to face occupation forces. With no civilian areas targeted from both sides, status quo seems to have remained unchanged. It's the first time the Israelis launched such an attack against Lebanon since the 2006 war, but it's also the first time since then that the Lebanese resistance retaliates with multiple rockets against an Israeli military occupation post. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick, and healed, and made well, and afflicted, and sat upon the throne, and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
In an unprecedented move, Saudi Arabia has sentenced dozens of Palestinians and Jordanians. Now, these developments or detainments were made in the year 2018 on alleged links with an unnamed terrorist group. Why would the kingdom take such a decision at this time? What could have triggered this move? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether Saudi Arabia, which has stated its support for Palestinians, is now turning against them. Let's find out more about this from our correspondent, Mano Kandil, who joins us from occupied Ramallah. Well, tell us more about the detainments that have occurred, and given the fact that these are Palestinians.
Well, reports now are saying that we are speaking about 69 Palestinians and Jordanians who are affiliated with the Hamas movement. They were arrested by the Saudi kingdom in 2018, including one of those who were detained is Dr. Mohammed Al-Khudri. He is Hamas representative in Saudi Arabia. He was arrested with his son. However, when he was detained, he had been, or he's being treated for cancer, and his health condition is very deteriorating. Amnesty International is demanding Saudi Kingdom to immediately release him. However, there are no accusations against them. According to a statement by Hamas movement, those who were detained by Saudi Kingdom, they didn't do anything. They didn't commit anything that they deserve for it, a trial, harsh sentences, and unjustified sentences. At the same time, some of those Palestinians have received, it was decided that they would be released from prison. Hamas movement also called on Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to release all of those who were arrested. Hamas movement, as well as the Jihad resistance movement, slammed the unjustified ruling by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, especially that Saudi Arabia is accusing those that they are being affiliated with a unknown group, a terrorist group, without saying who is this group or who it's supporting any country or any state.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We appreciate Mona Kandil there from Occupied Ramallah. Okay, let's introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. From the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier joins us from Edinburgh. Also joining us, journalist and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mustafa, who joins us from London. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both then. Hafsa Kara Mustafa, let me first start with you. So what we're looking at here is a court in Saudi Arabia, which has delivered a verdict. We understand there's 69 Palestinians and Jordanians handing jail terms of up to 22 years to come to some of them. There's also reports that some may also get acquitted. Tell us your reaction to this and why you think this is coming at this time.
I think the Saudi government, through its monarch, has been attempting to sell normalization with Israel for quite a few years now, but they're really hesitant in sort of going about it in a very frontal way and sort of really don't have the guts, so to speak, to do it the way the Emirates have done it so blatantly. So what they're doing is they're sort of taking tiny steps towards this normalization and make Saudi opinion accept the idea of an anti-Palestinian narrative, coupled, of course, with a normalization of Saudi-Israeli relations. Now, we've seen it just very recently during the Olympic Games with the encouragement of the Saudi judo player to confront her Israeli counterpart. And despite losing in a rather humiliating way, was nevertheless congratulated by the current Saudi sovereign. So we're obviously seeing these tentative steps made by Saudi Arabia towards normalization. They can't do it very openly, so what they're doing is step by step. And this, of course, is a major step in denouncing first Hamas, in turning against Hamas, breaking international law and the diplomatic law. Remember, Al-Khudri is actually essentially a diplomat who was residing in Saudi Arabia in very official capacity. There was nothing wrong with what he was doing. Rather, he was actually representing Hamas government in Saudi Arabia. And therefore, his stay in Saudi was an official one and perfectly legal one. And yet here he was finding himself arrested and behind bars during hospitalization. So this is obviously a step towards distancing Saudi Arabia from Palestine and the Palestinian cause. and appealing and appeasing Israel and showing that Saudi Arabia is making these tentative steps towards normalization.
Okay. Before we get into how, given this premise that you have told us, House of Karim Mustafa McNapp here, tell us, based on what she has said, what type of conversation could there be between Saudi Arabia and Israel? I mean, what happens? Israel says, hey, Saudi Arabia, you got to do something in order to appease us. Is that how it goes down? I mean, I'm trying to figure this out. Maybe you can help us out here, McNapp here. And then they zoom in on, okay, let's jail some Palestinians. Is that how this went down, you think?
I mean, if that conversation took place, I wasn't a fly on the wall, but I doubt it was like that. I think the Saudis calculate, and Mohammed bin Salman calculates his own self-interest very, very, very carefully. The other commentator's right. There's a geopolitical basis for this, and it is Saudi Arabia edging closer and closer in the open to an alliance with Israel, which would have to be an alliance against the Palestinians, much as Egypt, for example, joins in the siege of Gaza and allies with Egypt, allies with Israel against the people of Gaza. There's precedent there. So that there's a logic at the level of geopolitics. But I would just add one other thing, and I think it's quite dramatic. Mohammed bin Salman is much more interested in trying to ingratiate himself with Washington than with Tel Aviv. He sees the road to Washington running through Tel Aviv, but his main concern is with the U.S. empire, and he's never quite cleared his reputation after his people dissolved Khashoggi in acid in the consulate in Ankara. And there's something much, much bigger coming down the road as well, because we're coming up to an anniversary of 9/11, and Biden promised to be tough on Mohammed bin Salman when he was running for president. Once in the office, he's actually gone very quiet on that. But the families of the 9/11 victims have said that if Biden doesn't reveal information about the Saudi involvement in the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center, then they will protest and demonstrate and make him unwelcome when he turns up to the commemoration events in New York. Now, what can you do if you're Mohammed bin Salman when you've dissolved somebody in acid and been caught? When I think it was 13 of the 15 of those involved in the 9/11 attacks were from Saudi Arabia, and they were then spirited out of the U.S. pretty quickly. The families of the victims are something which Biden can't quite digest. I think he's heading for a very difficult situation on the anniversary of 9/11, and I think that Mohammed bin Salman thinks to ingratiate himself with Israel, of course, but I think he thinks to ingratiate himself with powerful elements in Washington by throwing a few Palestinians, if not executing them, then giving them decades and decades in his dungeons. Look, the notion of a Saudi court is a strange idea. Every decision is taken by the security apparatus. The judges have no autonomy at all. They're mere ciphers. This was decided at the highest level, and these Palestinians are simply, what can I say? They've been held as hostages. They're an indication to Washington and Tel Aviv that Mohammed bin Salman knows that his alliance with Washington and Tel Aviv trumps any popular support in Saudi Arabia for the Palestinians. They've been treated in the most cynical and calculating manner, and they're going to spend decades in a dungeon in order to smooth Mohammed bin Salman's path to Washington.
All right, so we need to, if you can, actually take us to the particular veteran Hamas leader who was jailed. In this case, his son was also jailed, and his name is Mohammed al-Qudaini, who was jailed for 15 years, Hafsah Karim Mustafa, from what we understand. And he was a Hamas representative for a long time, and his son, Hani, was also sentenced to 3 years. Now, based on what our guest there said, is this Saudi Arabia's way to appease the U.S. because of that pressure that Biden is getting from U.S. lawmakers with the 9/11 deal? Or is it both? both Israel and the U.S., which Saudi Arabia is trying to appease. So to hit, bird with two stones with one bird.
Well, I think the two are indissociable, to be honest, because I think that whatever Israel wants, the U.S. will comply with. And there's been a sort of a shift in relationship whereby, you know, a few decades ago, it was whatever the U.S. wanted, Israel went along. Today, it's whatever Israel wants, the U.S. has to go along as a result of the incredible influence Israeli lobbyists have on Washington. So Israel now really pulls the strings of many Washington senators and high figures in the political arena, and therefore whatever appeals to Israel will automatically appeal to the U.S. government. So basically, I mean, there is a case, obviously, for Biden to go to do something about the 9/11. But to be honest, if the interests of Israel trump those of the 9/11 families, I think the interest of Israel will prevail. And this indeed is designed to appeal to Israel and to sort of show the Saudis that they're really willing to do anything to please Israel and therefore please the puppet string pullers of Washington. There was no particular reason for these arrests. There was no clear case of why they're actually being arrested. It's a perfect violation of diplomatic law and international law, and as well as sort of inter-Arab relations. These are people who were living perfectly legally in Saudi Arabia, who were often raising funds for Hamas in a very official capacity with the support and backing of Saudi officials. So there was nothing that they were doing or any indication that they were doing anything wrong other than being simply arrested in order to be thrown under the bus to show Israel that Saudi Arabia is willing to do whatever it takes to please it. So I think the element here really is about pleasing Israel. And it also shows how low Mohammed bin Salman is willing to go to please Tel Aviv and also to distance himself essentially from the Palestinian cause and accustom Saudi opinion to this distance with the Palestinian cause, because obviously it's a slow and low process. I mean, population in Saudi Arabia remains overall in favor of Palestinian liberation, is supportive of the Palestinian cause, but slowly but surely they're gnawing into that sort of idea of unconditional support for the Palestinian people as a fellow Arab and fellow Muslim people, and they're gnawing into that and destroying that solidarity. And in doing that, it's these little small steps that are going towards destroying that once very warm and close relationship between the peoples of Saudi Arabia and Palestine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see here. If we were to take a look at this McNabb here, based on what you said, and tie this in with also pleasing the United States, we're looking again at this ruling that took place for somebody who for over two decades was responsible for managing the relationship with Saudi Arabia, and that is the veteran Hamas leader that I mentioned. Now, taking a look at a particular report that said sources in the Gaza Strip have actually said that they believe the crackdown was linked to warming of ties between Israel and Riyadh. Do you think that this then really is a departure or the beginning of the departure? Not that there was really support there of Saudi Arabia from Palestinians, because we know that Saudi Arabia indeed didn't really go that much out there to support the Palestinians, especially during the wars.
It was mainly for public consumption. And Riyadh was always well aware that it reported to the same head office as the Israelis did. Look, when Mohammed bin Salman addressed a pro-Israel meeting in New York a couple of years ago, I can't remember the particular Jewish organizations who pulled it together, but there was a report afterwards by some of the pro-Israel lobby who were participating, who heard Mohammed bin Salman, and they said that the audience were shocked by Mohammed bin Salman's hostility towards Palestine and denunciations of the Palestinians, basically singing the long-term Israeli song that Israel had offered generous deals to the Palestinians, and the Palestinians were too stupid to accept these generous deals. That was what Mohammed Salman said, and he said it so forcefully that the pro-Israel audience were absolutely shocked. So there's nothing radically new here. I have a slightly different framework from our other guest in approaching this analysis. But the basic point is, you can only tell about the relationship, the strategic relationship between Israel and America when their interests diverge. And on the issue of Saudi Arabia, there's no divergence. Mohammed bin Salman is out to duplicate Israel. He's out to duplicate the USA. There's no need to choose between the two. And he's throwing Palestinians under the bus in the most cynical fashion. He was caught in a way that he didn't expect in Ankara when he dissolved Khashoggi. In this occasion, he's openly snatching Palestinian diplomats and others off the street and condemning them to a long period in dungeons. No pretense of justice, not even an accusation that they dropped litter in the street. It's simply, in earlier days, they would have been burned at the stake as an offering to America and Israel. But on this occasion, it's going to be a decade or a decade and a half in the dungeons. But I make this point again. Egypt is enforcing the siege of Gaza, responsible for all the cruelty there, almost on a par with Israel. From Morocco, most Arab states at one time or another have been treacherous towards the Palestinians, and the Palestinians paid mightily. The Hamas authorities in Gaza now have very few options. Their resistance has been amazing and has unified Palestinians a couple of months ago in an unprecedented manner when they came to the rescue of the Al-Aqsa Mosque with rockets from Gaza. But their popularity has risen. Uh-huh. Palestinian national unity has benefited, but they are still in a huge prison. And with the UAE, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, most of the Arab regimes hostile and allied with Israel, their options are running out.
Well, let's take a look at what Hamas has said in reaction. An official from Hamas has said that, who resides in the Persian Gulf country for decades, Saudi Arabia, accusing it of targeting everyone who is linked with resistance against the Israeli occupation. Of course, this comes on top of the condemnation that followed from Hamas, calling these rulings unjust, and that they were shocked by these rulings. Is this a way for Saudi Arabia to target, yes, we know Palestinians, but to target Hamas in particular, which is part of this resistance groups, of course, Hamas being the major one that Israel has to deal with? Hafsakar Mustafa, go ahead.
Well, it's doing that because it's a sort of an easier sell for Western audiences, given that the U.S. And many Western governments have declared Hamas to be a terrorist organization. Therefore, it's kind of more consumable for Western public opinion to view Hamas as the bad guy in this equation, whereas Fatah is almost seen as the sort of the good guys in the relationship. So it's an easier sell. But essentially, I think it's also, there are geopolitical reasons, of course, including amongst, within relationships within the GCC, between those who are affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, and all those other things that are coming into it. So it's easier to go after people from Hamas than other groups. But I think essentially, the meaning behind this decision is to distance Saudi Arabia from the Palestinian cause and be extraordinary and take a very sort of bold and severe move, and also and telling sort of Palestinians that actually you're no longer safe in Saudi Arabia, because these are people who came in very official capacities, even recognized and working closely with the government. I mean, you can't be more official than Al-Khutbi, and yet here that he was taken from his hospital bed and arrested. So it's also an indication to Palestinians residing in Saudi Arabia that actually they're no longer safe in that country, and they can be arrested at will at any time, thrown in prison simply at the sovereign's will in order to please Israel. So, I think because Hamas would have been an easier option, but it's not necessarily that. I think it's an indication that Palestinians really are no longer safe in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia is slowly but surely distancing itself from Palestine.
Final question now. You know the Abraham Accords there, McNapier. So this, from what I'm gathering, is not a one-off from Saudi Arabia. Are we looking at a formalization of the coming out from the closet of the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Israel? Although we know that clandestine they have had a relationship, but of course the Abraham Accords is bringing out these Persian Gulf countries. Do you think Saudi Arabia will soon do that?
How soon? I don't know. I mean, as our other guest says, there's a hard nut to chew on in terms of a public opinion, which has traditionally, perhaps in dubious ways, but has been whipped up against Israel, and Israel has been seen as a very malign force indeed in terms of Saudi public opinion. To change that can't be done overnight, and I think that's why the Saudis are edging, as our guest said, towards that. But there's no doubt at all, they want to have an open recognition of Israel. They want embassies and ambassadors exchanged, and it's only a case of bringing out into the open the alliance that has been very real for quite a long time. I mean, there's the cost is to be borne by the Palestinians. They are to be made unwelcome, and they must be feeling dangerous now. In the famous Hollywood movie Casablanca, the chief of police says, go and get me the usual suspects. Well, Mohammed bin Salman's agents must have said, go and get me a certain number of Palestinians. Uh-huh. They're a currency to be used in Saudi's relationship with Israel and with America. They are innocent victims, and they have been sacrificed in the most disgraceful manner.
All right, thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guests at the top of the hour. We had our correspondent, Monica Neal from Occupied Ramallah, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, McNapier there, and journalist and political analyst, Hafsa Kara Mustafa. Thank you for your comments. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitaglay, it's goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
For millions of working Americans, being employed doesn't guarantee a living income, says Jeffrey Kakek, writer, in an article published under the heading, At least 27 million U.S. workers can't afford all basic necessities of life. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. For millions of working Americans, being employed doesn't guarantee a living income. As scholars interested in the well-being of workers, experts believe that the economy runs better when people aren't forced to choose between paying rent, buying food, or getting medicine. Yet too many are compelled to do just that. Determining just how many workers struggle to make ends meet is a complicated task. A worker's minimum survival budget can vary considerably based on where the person lives and how many people are in the family. Take Rochester, New York. It has a cost of living that's closest to the national average across 509 U.S. metropolitan areas, according to the City Cost of Living Index compiled by the research firm Advisor Smith. MIT's living wage calculator shows that a single adult living in Rochester needs at least $30,000 a year to cover the cost of housing, food, transportation, and other basic needs. But in San Francisco, which Advisory Smith data indicate is the U.S. city with the highest cost of living, affording just the basics, cost $47,587, mainly due to significantly higher taxes and rents. The city with the lowest cost of living is Berkeley, West Virginia. Even there, a childless worker still needs to earn about $28,200 to make essential ends meet. Again, the average American city has a cost of living of around $30,000 a year for a single person. Of course, costs add up quickly for households with more than 1%. Two adults in Rochester need over $48,000 a year, while a single parent with one child needs more than $63,000. In San Francisco, a single parent would need to earn $101,000 a year just to scrape by. So that's what it takes to survive in today's America. About $30,000 a year for a single person without dependents in the average city, a little less in some cities, and much, much more for families and anyone who lives in a major city like San Francisco or New York. But we estimate that at least 27 million U.S. workers don't earn enough to hit that very low threshold of $30,000 based on the latest occupation wage data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, a government agency, from May 2020. Experts believe this is a conservative estimate and that the number of people with jobs who earn less than what's necessary to afford the necessities of life is, like, much higher. Low-income occupations encompass a wide range of jobs, from bus drivers to cleaners to administrative assistants. However, the majority of those 27 million workers are concentrated into industries, retail trade, and leisure and hospitality. These two industries are among America's largest employers and pay the lowest average wages. For example, the median salary for cashiers was $28,850 in early 2020, with 2.5 million of the nation's 5 million cashiers earning less than that. Or take retail sales. There, 75% of workers, about 1.8 million, were earning less than $27,080 a year. It's the same story for leisure and hospitality, the industry that took the hardest hit from the COVID-19 pandemic, hemorrhaging 6 million jobs in April 2020 as much of the U.S. economy shut down. At the time, close to a million waiters and waitresses were earning less than the median income of $23,740. Of course, millions of those jobs have returned, and wages have been surging this year, though only slightly more than inflation. But that doesn't change the basic math that roughly one in six workers is making less than what's necessary for an adult with no kids to survive. And that's why it's hardly surprising that 40% of U.S. households reported in 2018 that they couldn't afford an emergency $400 expense. These figures should cause policymakers to redefine who counts among the working poor, experts say. A 2021 Bureau of Labor Statistics report estimated that in 2019, about 6.3 million workers earned less than the poverty rate. But this situation drastically understates the scope of the working poor because the federal poverty line is unrealistically low, only $12,880 for an individual. The official poverty line was created to determine eligibility for Medicaid and other government benefits that support low-income people, not to indicate how much a person needs to actually get by. Writer James Truslow Adams coined the phrase the American Dream in 1931 to describe a society in which He hoped anyone could attain the fullest stature of which they are innately capable. That depended on having a good job that paid a living wage. Unfortunately, for many millions of hard-working Americans, the better and richer and fuller life Adams wrote about remains just a dream.
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.